Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From Hollywood, California, the horror capital of the world, the Boulay Brothers, Creatures of the Night.
Welcome, everyone, to an all-new episode of the Boulay Brothers' Creatures of the Night. It's an exciting time here in Boulay world, and there is a lot going on, so we're going to get right to it. But I couldn't possibly do this alone, so joining me now, as always, is my darkest and deadliest sister in crime, Jack Morda. Jack Morda, darling, how are we tonight?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
Doing as good as always and as great as could be expected. We're in a new year. There's new dragons to slay, and I know our weapons are sharpened and ready to destroy.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the ticket sales for the tour, because that is quickly approaching.
Right to
I know. Can you tell I'm excited?
I'm excited too, actually, because, you know, it's a new season. It's a new tour. Like, this is a bigger tour than we've ever done before with the show.
Absolutely.
So, you know, even though I knew it would be amazing.
Did you know or did I know?
Well, you definitely knew. You know, I'm cautious about everything.
It's true. You are cautious, and I'm a little bit more throwing cautious to the wind and, like, diving in.
So. But in a smart way. You never put us into some situation where, like, you did that.
Oh, no. This has already been discussed on the podcast before. I have an inner Martha who's, like, a rules Martha, and it definitely would err on the side of caution. But sometimes I know our worth, and this was one of them. Like, I knew after season 4 and Shudder and everything together that once we announced those tours that people would be excited that the Dragula monsters are coming to their city.
I'm excited. We've seen this brand grow from just a little idea to what it is today. So it's exciting to see.
Part of the thing that makes me the most excited about the live tour, yes, I love the live experience. And I think drag is best experienced live because all that energy you can't really see on TV. But we've taken the season 3 tour, the season 2 tour, and even just the two of us. And when we get in front of new audiences, the wigs just get disintegrated. Like, we put on
not
a show.
Ours, of course.
No, not no. Ours, unless it's on purpose. I haven't mastered that gag yet. Yeah. We put on a show that people are just not used to. If you like punk and dark and deadly and crazy, like, that's what the Dragula show delivers.
Yes, I think so too. I think too, one of the things I'm excited about is we're going to have the opportunity to feature people from other seasons too. It's not just all people from season 4. Like I said, everyone's chipped in to build the brand, so I like to spread it around and keep everyone as involved as possible.
I agree, totally. And it's not just there, too, because, of course, we're back to the grind. It's a new year, a new day, and we're looking at all the different ways that we might be able to, like, branch out and sort of deliver some different stuff as far as, like, the TV world.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's a lot of stuff, like, sort of in the development stages.
Yes. It's going to be a big couple of years for the Boulay Brothers Dragula. We kept saying this before. Season 4 was almost like season 1 for us. And I think we made a massive splash. And now I think we can start to explore more of the Dragula world. What else is out there? How else can we open more doors in the mansion to show more that's going on behind the scenes, you know? And so that's what we're working on.
I love
right
that. Yeah. Yeah. There's so much happening, you know, with season 5. But for Shudder, the fans and the world, we're really just, like, buzzing all about what's next. And just to give the fans a clue, we do want to do a lot more with the stars. Like Drax said, you haven't seen the last of some of the monsters that you've grown to know and love. Even if they didn't win, we'll think of crafty little ways to bring them back and get them back on your TV screen.
Yeah. I mean, I love so many of the competitors on the show, and they only got to show a certain amount. And I think with Resurrection, we were able to show that, hey, there's more to these people than what you see in a competition setting. And so that was exciting to me, and I think our team, to show them in a different light. And there's even more new ways that we can show them that people will learn about very soon.
Very, very soon. And what about the vinyl stuff? We kind of blew by the musical releases. Like, I think Time to Die had a really big splash when the season launched. And of course, Wicked Love got a lot of attention because a challenge was sort of set to that. But post the season, we've had a couple of songs come out on the Time to Die EP, and those things are being pressed to vinyl.
That's right. We're kind of announcing that for the first time here. We will be releasing a vinyl of our Time to Die EP the next couple of months. I'm sure it takes a little while, but that's exciting, I think.
No, for sure. There's lots of little cauldrons on the fire. And we don't tend those cauldrons alone. I think it's the perfect time to bring in our co-producer and cohort, Ian DeVogler. Ian, welcome to the show.
Ooh, I'm a little teapot, but I'm also the tiniest little cauldron on the kettle. Hi, how are you guys?
We're good. How are you?
I am feeling fabulous tonight.
Yeah?
Yeah, totally.
Coming back to life a little bit?
A little bit. I don't want to say I'm coming back to life because there's something fun and fabulous about being undead or unalive or whatever. Mm. But yeah, I think the world is kind of coming back. I have lots of fun current events when we get to that point. I'm feeling good.
Don't tease, you have to deliver now. Let us know what's going on in the world of horror and Hollywood.
For tonight's ghoulish and grotesque phantasmagorical features, I want to start by saying a final farewell to the delays and dismay of the past, and begin the summoning of sequels, new releases, and news of brand new teases from the worlds of Hollywood and horror. We've had a number of news items recently, with studios announcing their next moves in the horror space. To start, streaming service Tubi is getting their claws into the original horror landscape with the announcement of their new show, Hellblazers, which stars a number of classic genre actors such as Tony Todd in the leading role, Bruce Dern, and Adrienne Barbeau, to name a few cast members. In addition to new original series, this week also saw the announcement of direct sequels to two beloved, at least in my opinion, franchises, 2021's Mortal Kombat with The Exorcist and Disney Plus's upcoming anti-hero series Moon Knight writer Jeremy Slater at the helm, and the sixth entry into the Final Destination franchise, which will be coming to HBO Max, produced by John Watts, fresh off his success directing Spider-Man No Way Home. Not to be missed either were two teases at future projects, with Nightmare Alley actor Ron Perlman stating that fans deserved a third entry in the Guillermo del Toro Hellboy franchise in a recent interview for The Independent, and the creative team behind Scream 5 reportedly working on ideas for the sixth entry in the newly revitalized Scream universe.
Wow. Okay, we'll get to Scream, but I wanted to jump all over Adrienne Barbeau because I was gagged.
I knew you would love that. Yeah. Yeah.
I do, of course, love to hear that. However, then you said the magic words, Guillermo del Toro.
Woo,
because
girl.
Anything from her mind, like, I'm right there in the front row, fresh box of popcorn and ready to do it.
Absolutely. I recently rewatched Hellboy because I haven't seen it since I was a kid. And I was like, okay, one, also Ron Perlman as Hellboy. I'm like, hot into it.
Ugh, gross.
But it's like so good. It's like, it's a creature feature. Doug Jones is in it. It's got really great villains, got great fights. It's a fantasy. And of course, Guillermo del Toro just puts his stamp all over it. It's like kind of one of my favorites in his universe.
Yeah, so good.
He is ruined for me.
Oh, here we go.
No, I love the movies, but this is so stupid. Do you remember when we were at Hollywood Horror Nights?
I can't believe you're going
here. I'm going to go here because I can't help it. We were like going into this maze and we didn't know what it was because the movie hadn't come out yet. Because I think it was supposed to release before Hollywood Horror Nights, but it didn't. So we're like, what is this maze? So like part of the maze, you go in the front, all the lights turn off, and then this video.
This projection or something.
I think you should finish the story. Know,
whatever. It's not that good, but like, okay, a projection of Guillermo del Toro came out and he was like, I am Guillermo del Toro and welcome to my maze. But he really didn't say that, but in our recollection,
he did.
That's our retelling, like the game of telephone. Mm-hmm. So in our memory, it was, oh, remember when we went to Hollywood Horror Nights and it was like, I am Guillermo del Toro. Welcome to my maze.
Not anything he does. It's like, I'm this. Welcome to my comic book. Welcome to my TV show, whatever. And I'm like, So.
I know you guys haven't seen it yet. And this is a minor spoiler for Nightmare Alley. But now all I can think of is, I am Guillermo del Toro. And here is Bradley Cooper's penis.
Exactly.
Exactly. That's what it is. You catch on so quickly.
For listeners who love a bit of horror history, and for any aspiring realtors of the night in the audience tonight, Nancy's house from the original A Nightmare on Elm Street has officially sold for just under its asking price of $3.25 million. located at 1428 North Genesee Avenue in Los Angeles, California, the horror capital of the world. The house is a frequent stop for tourists looking to see a bit of horror history, as the outer facade is nearly identical to the way it appeared in the actual film, the only notable difference being that the front door has been replaced, probably due to Freddy Krueger dragging Nancy's mom through the upper window in the iconic end of the film.
Which I just saw the craziest meme of a guy, like, kind of half, he was like, you know, obviously cut out and photoshopped in a very small window, and it was like a very big dude.
Oh my God. I always love the ending of that movie, because I think that was one of the first, like, you know, it's like horror movies used to always do that. It was like, they did that with Carrie. They did it with Nightmare on Elm Street. It was, there was all
Friday the 13th.
Yeah,
also,
there's always like, and the end of the movie is here. And one last jump scare.
Yeah,
and
totally.
That was the one that really got me as a kid. Like, bye everyone. And then like the hood of the car comes up and it's like, ooh, there's your mini scare. And then that bitch gets fully just back broken through. I was like, oh.
I always wondered if it was like on purpose to make it look strange and cartoony, because it was so weird, you know, that she could, I don't know.
It looks really funny too.
It
like,
does.
Even like in the remaster of it, like it's like the one effect that they couldn't fix in any
way. They couldn't figure it out.
It's bad.
It made it scarier to me. I don't know.
I thought it was effective. I mean, I haven't seen it in years, but when I think back, I'm like, you got me, sis. You know,
yeah.
They definitely
Yeah, I don't
me.
Know why it was scarier. Like, is it still a dream or something? I don't know.
Like,
yeah.
It does have that quality. I mean, because the whole movie, it's like, you know, you have Freddy in the dreamscape, but then you also have like Nancy and like, hi, I turned my house into Home Alone somehow with like these like weird bombs and stuff. So I'm also addicted to sleeping pills. Like, there's a lot of shit happening in that movie.
It was a lot.
And finally, iconic creature actor and friend of the show, Doug Jones, is being honored for his many contributions to the entertainment industry from the Makeup Artists and Hairstylists Guild with the inaugural The Chair Award.
The Chair Award?
Yeah, it's called The Chair Award, and I'm assuming because he sits in the chair to have his makeup get done.
Okay, I was like, I'm picturing like a big gold chair. I'm like, why would someone want a golden chair?
Do you really need to be rewarded and awarded to be sitting in a chair? But I get it, it's Doug Jones.
Right, I'm like, well, it's Doug Jones. You know, I mean, of course, I feel like Astrid Aurelia is going to be listening. It's just like, you will put respect on Doug Jones's name.
We love Doug Jones, but I don't want a golden chair.
Well, that's all I have today.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Ian, for those updates. And for those listening at home, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll be reviewing the new Scream film in this episode's Creature Feature Movie Review. Stay tuned.
UK fans of the Boulay Brothers Dragula, now is your time. The official Boulay Brothers Dragula World Tour kicks off in the UK this March with stops in Edinburgh, Glasgow, Newcastle, Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, London, Nottingham, Leeds, Sheffield, Brighton, and Bristol. We'll be bringing our top competitors of the season with us for a show you'll have to see to believe. General admission and meet and greet tickets are on sale now at DragulaLive.com. Join us or die.
Welcome back, darlings, to the Boulay Brothers Creatures of the Night Creature Feature Movie Review. For this episode's film, we chose to watch and review 2022's Scream, or as some have called it, Scream 5, directed by Radio Silence, consisting of Matt Bettinelli-Ulpin and Tyler Gillette, and written by James Vanderbilt and Guy Busick. We wanted to give fans a chance to watch this film before we reviewed it, and it's been a few weeks, so let's dig in.
I have come to know this movie as Five Cream. That's just me.
Well, Peaches and Scream? Was that the ice cream?
Oh, yeah, totally.
So we all went and saw this together.
We did.
And what did you think? I mean, let's just say overall.
I'll go first. Overall, I want to put my foot right in my mouth, because I think on the last episode I said, I'm scared Scream is going to suck. They're trying so hard and I'm just nervous because I know it's not going to be good. Like, my sixth sense was tingling and it was totally wrong. Like, I think it was a great addition to the Scream franchise, and I thought it was super fun, and I walked out a very happy moviegoer.
I am going to basically mirror that. I really enjoyed it. I do not think it's a perfect movie, but I do think it's way better than 3 or 4. I was very, very happy. Despite its flaws, it's just fucking fun.
Hmm.
Oh, what do you think, Drac?
Well, You know, I honestly think it was kind of middle of the road.
Okay.
I didn't love it and I didn't hate it. Not very memorable to me. I mean, we could get into the specifics of why. And I think we talked about this a little. I feel like when Scream originally came out, it was really smart and fast and cutting and kind of edgy in that it was self-aware and all these things. And it felt very young and different. And this one just felt not updated in that way. It didn't seem like sharp and edgy for today's audiences to me. Like it felt nostalgic or something, I guess.
I think that you are right. It is a nostalgic sort of movie. They did try to update it. They have one of the main characters, Tara, at the very beginning. She's like, oh, I prefer films like The Babadook or Hereditary, and it's elevated horror and it's this. And so I think it tries to poke fun at those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But I will say, I still do think that those films are great for a reason.
Right.
But, you know, I can definitely see it was more nostalgic than it was like fresh and edgy. But
I think that was the point. This reminded me why Scream was and is so fun. It felt like a natural extension. It belonged in the 1 through 5. It wasn't like, oh, 20 years has passed and now this is like totally fresh and new. Like they were addressing some modern changes in the world of horror and like what was going on, even the technology of like being able to lock the house with your phone and all that. Kind of clever, but still existing in the Scream world, not updated to like 2022.
What did you all think of the use of nostalgic characters? You know, like Gale and Sydney, to me, they seem like very kind of underused and like they didn't really find it out or figure it out. We're here at the house at the end and we're going to kick this girl in the stomach a couple of times and like, right? But they weren't really like integral to the story, right?
Yeah, I think that they are maybe more resetting up Sydney to kind of be the main character again, because I think they really tried to push this main character of Sam, who, you know, is maybe not my favorite protagonist that's ever existed in the Scream franchise. I really do think they kind of do Dewey really wrong in the movie. I like the way, spoiler alert, I like his death scene, but I do feel like I'm like, oh, I mean, Dewey has been stabbed 50 fucking times. Like, let him have a win.
I always think that in these movies, the same thing with Halloween that uses a lot of, recently at least, they use a lot of characters from the original film. And I'm like, why did you bring them back just to kill them like that?
Just to sell movie tickets?
Why did you bring them back just to cut bangs in their long black hair?
Oh,
don't get me started.
That was one thing I did like. I think that, yes, it is nostalgic, but I think it works in some ways because they do take the opportunity to poke fun at themselves. You know, there is that scene where it's almost like a throwaway where Gale off screen is heard saying, and remind me, if I ever try to get bangs again, just shoot me.
Oh, totally.
I was going to say, they should have made her do bangs again too.
I was talking about Kyle Richards.
I know.
But Gale's fucked up bangs were like a thing. Like they were like their own supporting character.
Oh, totally. I watched a recap of the Scream franchise before we went to see it. And, you know, it's like Gale's bangs live somewhere in the mental soup of my brain, but I don't think about her bangs all the time. And so when her bangs flashed on screen, I was like, holy shit.
It was the most memorable thing from the recap to me. Because I was like, what is that baby bang thing? What is that?
But it
that?
Was like punk rock baby bang. I was like, girl, the 90s was fucked up. Yeah.
Totally.
Hey, but I thought the best use of a legacy character was the spooky reflections of Billy Loomis.
Oh, man. Okay.
And I'm not kidding. Like, I thought it was super Yeah, it was, like, ridiculous and campy. And I was like, do I love this? Yes, I do.
I'll meet you, like, a quarter of the way. I really love the first time they did it where Sam is, like, shaking the pill out of the bottle. And she's like, oh, I'm having a moment. And she looks in the mirror. And there's Billy Loomis. And I was like, wow, they made Skeet Ulrich look real young. But then they kept bringing her back. And I was like, the longer you put him on screen, the more I'm looking at the makeup and I'm not happy.
Yeah.
Well, Heather Matarazzo was in it too, who we know from Welcome to the Dollhouse. Ian was like, who the hell's that?
It's Dawn Wiener.
I know. I love that she was in this, but she was in Scream 3 too. And I didn't realize that until I kind of was researching it again.
Yeah.
But that was kind of fun. But it was weird because she was like an older mom character.
Yeah, she was like a frumpy mom. And I'm like, isn't she supposed to be the 12-year-old doing that little like thumb dance move?
I kind of secretly wish she had been the killer. That would have been fun.
Oh my God. Well, I mean, maybe we'll get to that. Like, that's my one big...
She didn't die.
Oh, the mom?
Heather did not die in that movie.
Oh.
Remember? Sorry, go ahead.
The reveal of the killers is maybe my one big gripe with the movie. Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. My big one gripe with the movie is the scene where they talk about, well, it's the requel, and it's the this, and it's the that. And I'm like, oh, I already see what you're doing. You don't have to spell it out like that. I get it. It's okay.
That was the scene when I was sitting there, and I was like, listen. I was talking to Swan about it, and I was like, if you were like cornering these people, and especially these two legendary people that you're like worshiping, mm-hmm. and you're like, I'm getting ready to kill all these people, right? And you're there with your friend. You wouldn't be like having a conversation mm-hmm. like casually, like you're not worried at all. You're not concerned at all that these five people are going to turn on you and take you out.
And then I had to look, I'm like,
and it's then she got mad at me.
I'm like, don't ruin this for me. I'm having fun and it's not meant to be taken seriously.
But I'm like, why are you scared 5 minutes ago? Now you're in the kitchen having a conversation like you're just hanging out at coffee. I don't know. I thought it was weird.
Well, I think that that's maybe one of the things that makes the original kind of magical is because it's not like a lot of elevated horror where there's like a sense of pervasive dread throughout. There is a lot of fun that happens in the original Scream and in Five Cream. Like,
yeah.
You know, there's, but I mean, one thing I will say is I thought that they really brought the violence to a modern level and I really appreciate it.
Oh,
they didn't pull
yes.
any punches.
You can like see in it the right beginning,
from the
right?
first scene. Yeah.
Oh my,
yeah.
Girl, when they crushed that girl's leg, I was like, oh,
yeah.
Then we have a defense wound where she puts her hand up to not get slashed in the face and it goes right through her palm. Yeah. I'm like, okay, this isn't just a redo. We're not just like retracing our steps here.
Stab. That's what they call it in crime. TV.
Oh, Millie Shapiro would be really proud of you.
Millie, if you're listening, that one's for you. Mm-hmm. The one part that really made me squirm was from the defensive wound where Tara is in the wheelchair and she's kind of pushing herself through the hallway. And the actress who plays Tara, her name is Jenna Ortega. I thought she was the strongest actor in the entire cast because I was like, girl, you're making me believe that that shit hurts.
Oh, I think everyone thinks that because I read somewhere, I think she's going to have a more prominent role in the next one.
Oh,
the,
cool.
Yeah. I've been reading about her too. Well, first of all, she captured my imagination completely. Like a lot of close-ups, the camera loves her, very believable. I'm thinking like she's maybe reached like bonafide Scream Queen status with this, and I think that she's going to go on to do a lot more. Mm-hmm. There's an A24 movie called X, which I haven't seen the trailer for yet, but I know it's, you know, it's a horror movie and it's coming out soon. And she's also cast as Wednesday for Tim Burton's Netflix iteration of The Addams Family. So I'm super excited to see a lot more of her.
It's just
the
Wednesday
show,
right? I think it is. Is it just Wednesday?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
I'm very excited for that. I thought that she was great in this and I would definitely see her as Wednesday.
Yeah.
That's
sounds
fun.
Like a good guest judge for season 5.
Ooh,
putting it out there.
Jenna Ortega.
I do want to talk about one little trope that I thought they used to great effect. We've all seen a million horror movies.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to call it the like jump scare behind the refrigerator door trope. Mm-hmm. And we all have seen it a million times, usually at night when they go to the refrigerator and it opens and the camera
or the mirror
pans way in and then they close it and there's the jump. And in a very Scream way, in a very Five Cream way, you know, they did it like over and over. In the course of like a minute and a half, you saw it like 9 times in very different creative ways. It was the fridge. It was the cabinet. It was the swinging door into the dining room. And it just happened over and over and over until it happened. And that's why I love Five Cream, because it has that commentary about the horror world and things that we're all used to.
Every time it happened, you jumped out of your fucking seat and scared the fuck out of me. Oh, yeah, because so she was between the two of us this time.
I like being next to Ian, though, too, because I think we reacted a lot of the same way.
You scare the hell out of me in these movies. You are so jumpy.
Okay, I will say, Swan, you are jumpier than I've ever seen, because you're pretty steely when it comes to horror movies sometimes, and you are like,
but I'm a sucker for a jump scare.
Jump scares get hurt every time.
That's why I think they're so cheap. It's like the lowest hanging fruit in the horror world, and it just gets me.
You know, it's funny that we're talking about that scene with the sort of the classic horror jump scare, because that scene has the character Wes, who's played by Dylan Minnette. And I feel like they also played on another trope, which is the blonde in the shower. Mm-hmm. And I love that it was a guy. And I was like, it's done so well, because I'm like, he's not my type. And I was like, is this steamy shower scene hot? Ooh, yes. Oh, God, your terrible hair is really getting to me.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I didn't even think about the role reversal there. Because another aspect of Scream that I appreciate is a lot of the leads, it's very women driven.
Oh, the entire end of the film.
Tons of women of color too, like a lot of diversity, not just women of color too, just people of color across the board.
Queer women too.
Really, really diverse.
She's one of the best characters, honestly, I thought.
And I love the way that they incorporated these characters and it didn't feel like a diversity pick. And it really felt like these characters live in this universe. And it's like, these are actually the friends that you would have. Like, hi, there are queer people, there are people of color. It didn't feel like it was being quote unquote forced onto the movie or like it was done to prove a point. It was like, hi, this is the world we live in. And I just really appreciated that.
I agree. And I love it for that too.
I still think that Sydney and Gale were underused, extremely underused. I hope that maybe they'll have a bigger role in the next one, because to me, it's all about Sydney, right? That's the whole thing. So I don't
know. I did see Neve Campbell was just recently interviewed about her thoughts on returning for Scream 6. And she said that she's definitely open to it. But the one thing that she would not return for is if something bad happened to Sydney. She's like, you know, that kind of defeats the whole purpose in her eyes. Like, Sydney has really been
good for you, Sherry.
I know, totally. Well, I'm like, girl, if Sydney died in Scream 6, I'd be like, fuck you.
Hold on. And not to mention, I'm like, listen, Neve Campbell, look at what they did to Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween. She is like a granny hag from hell. And we know she don't look like that. They made her look like that. So hashtag. I'm like, they let you have little young kids and jogging around and being cute. I was like, let them do whatever they want to.
Oh my God. Hashtag granny hag from hell.
Honestly, the name of our first horror movie.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. Yes.
I love it. Actually.
Granny hag from hell.
Yeah. Hag horror. Yes.
Yes. And we're going to have to put the subject of Five Cream to bed with that.
I always wonder when we record these podcasts, how much of what we say will actually make it into the podcast. And this time I'm thinking maybe 30%.
No, I'm thinking like 90.
Honestly, girl, somewhere 65.
Let me believe 90.
Okay, so what are your final thoughts on Scream?
If you liked the first couple of Scream movies, you will love Scream 5. I think it's totally worth the trip to the theater. I encourage you to watch it there. And if not, you can catch it streaming when it comes out.
I'm going to pull a classic me and say, if you are really into seeing Scream, but you don't mind just turning your brain off in certain parts, enjoy it. It's a lot of fun and it's really bloody. So the gore hounds out there, enjoy.
And I'm going to say it's a fun trip to the movies, but you'll probably forget it.
We are going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we will be checking out some of our listener mail. Calling all misfits, mutants, and outcasts. The Boulay Brothers Dragula Season 4 U.S. Tour will be terrorizing a city near you this spring, featuring the Boulay Brothers and the top four monsters of Season 4. Tickets and VIP upgrades are available and going fast, so if you'd like the chance to experience the Dragula show live, get your tickets now at DragulaLive.com before they're all gone.
All right, welcome back, everyone. And we are going to dig right into some listener mail. Let's get the mailbag over there. Oh, wow. Quite a few letters this week.
Oh, God, it's full. Alyssa from London writes, my question is about episode 2 of season 4 of the Boulay Brothers Dragula, the Nosferatu Beach Party. Was the theme by any chance inspired by the Rammstein video Mineland?
No, but thank you, because I've since checked out this video and it definitely has a lot of the same blood flowing through its veins that the Nosferatu Beach Party vibe did. It's that 60s beach blanket babes inspiration for sure, but not inspired by it. I think we were both vibing on the same thing, but I checked it out afterward and it is really cute.
Alvin from North Carolina asks, I have heard you mention in a previous episode of the podcast that you like watching some campy movies at times, and I want to know what are your favorite ones and which ones would you recommend for listeners to watch?
I went to the horror ones because I think that there's some great like campy horror movies. If you've not seen Death Becomes Her, what is wrong with you? Run right now and just like check it out. Some of my personal favorites beyond that are American Werewolf in London, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and of course, Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Those are good ones. I think maybe if I had to add one from the horror space to that, I would say Prom Night 2.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a good one.
Nice. Which I think we talked about before on
Ian
the
mentioned Bright Night 2, which is also like a classic.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Super gay.
Yeah. Super campy and super gay.
Andrea from the UK asks, I wondered if there was a musical, apart from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, that really made a mark on either of you.
One musical that definitely left its mark on me is like Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, nice.
I loved it when I was a child. I still love it. We had some headpieces made in honor of that love. And the fledgling theater gay inhabiting my body at times also loved the drama of Phantom of the Opera.
Ooh, yeah.
Good choices.
Yeah.
Felicity from Pennsylvania writes, My mom and I are huge fans of the podcast. We love to listen to it. My favorite part is the haunting of history. My question is, out of all the places you've talked about, which one was your favorite and why?
I think my favorite is from, it might have been either episode one or two. It's the island that you...
Yeah, that's episode one.
Yes.
Pavlia or something like that, right? Pavelia? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The Italian island.
I think that's my favorite.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Even though I think my telling of that was a hot mess because we were just getting into that format. I kind of took a minute and chose my favorite kind of one from each of us because we each take turns telling the haunting. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, oh, it's my choice this week, or Ian's going to choose. I wonder what he chose. And oftentimes when we listen to it the first time, we hear it the first time. So it's kind of a surprise for us too. But from Drax, I loved the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter, like the little
that
green
one sticks
man.
Out to me too.
It was a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was good because it deviated a little bit. It kind of made me question, like, is this, what I say, haunting? But it was like that sci-fi horror hybrid that I felt definitely belonged in the haunting mm-hmm. format. From Ian's, it was the Hand of Glory.
Ring down. Yeah. Thank you.
I just thought that was such a cool artifact. I didn't know anything about it. So to hear about it, I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool.
Well, and then he bought us a Hand of Glory afterwards.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah.
Sitting on my shelves. And for me, it was Anna Baker's haunted wedding dress, which inspired a lot, which I just love the idea of like cursed or like poisoned clothing and dresses. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Carmen from Los Angeles asks, Swan, I heard on an older episode that you made some of the helmets you wore on season 4 of the Blair Brothers Dragula. How did you learn to bring your dark creations to life?
Yes, I did. And I kind of learned that I was a natural hat maker from the boss who taught me everything that I know. A friend of mine from our darker days in the Hollywood kind of like underground club scene kind of went on to form her own company. And she just makes these gorgeous hats and headpieces. Yeah, she kind of took me under her wing. Her business is called Bubbles and Frown. So if you want to see some amazing creations, like check out their social media.
Wes from New Zealand writes, I have adored watching Dragula since season 1 and was blown away with how amazing season 4 was. I noticed this season, apart from the photo shoot extermination challenge, that there were no on-location floor shows. Was this due to COVID making logistics difficult?
That's exactly what it was, actually. I'm glad that you noticed that because people did wonder, like, we usually go outside a lot more.
Yeah.
Which is something we love and I think sets the show apart. But every time you would want to go somewhere, it would be like, everyone has to be tested or who's exposed. Or this was like, nope, not happening.
Yeah. So. And it really was like so apparent. I think when we got to episode 8 and once that happened, I mean, it is genius for so many reasons. But just being outside and having like the clown cars and all of that shenanigans happening like out in the world, it was so fun. It's kind of wacky to see like these drag characters just out in the air quotes real world doing stuff like that. And you don't see it anywhere else on TV.
Yeah, I felt like we were filming season 2 again.
Oh,
we
yeah.
were doing that, or even season 1, honestly. Like, it was a lot of fun.
Pink Boy writes, I'm not a performer myself, but I have been inspired to create my own drag look. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on audience members wearing drag to your shows. I don't want to draw attention away from the performers, and I want to be respectful of the environment you wish to create.
Well, I think that's very considerate of you, Pink Boy, but I would say fucking do it up. Like, get dressed up, drag it out, come to the show, be expressive and loud. It's like a queer, safe, punk space. And I promise you, like, you won't take away from the performances. Like, they have the entirety of the stage. And if you want to be kind of part of that experience by dressing up and being part of the magic, we encourage you to do it 150%.
That's all the time we have for questions for this episode, but if you have a question you would like answered by us on air, please write to us at creatures@BouletBrothersDragula.com and let us know where you are writing from. We love to hear from you. Now, it's time to change the mood a little and bring down the lights as we prepare for this episode's Haunting of History. For this section of the show, we like to dig up a real-life, documented supernatural happening and give listeners an abridged history of the terrifying event. We encourage you to turn off the lights, find a dark, quiet place to relax in, and prepare for a journey into the unknown.
Sometimes history provides us with fascinating, horrifying, and spellbinding figures whose lives seem unimaginably exotic and grotesque. One of the most alluring and uniquely shrouded in mystique is the life and death of the enigmatic Russian Rasputin. Grigory Rasputin was considered by many to be a mad monk, a mystic capable of prophecy and a gifted healer with extraordinary powers. History characterizes him as highly magnetic, manipulative, spiritually gifted, and sexually depraved. Born to a peasant family on January 21st, 1869, in the Siberian village of Pokrovskoy, he had a remarkable religious conversion experience as a result of a pilgrimage in 1897 at the age of 28. He lived for a few years as a stranik, or wandering monk, until he found himself in St. Petersburg in 1903, where he captivated local members of both the church and society, ultimately befriending Emperor Nicholas and the Empress Alexandra Fedorovna, who was destined to be the last empress consort of the great Romanov dynasty of Russia. Alexandra was a favorite granddaughter of Queen Victoria of the United Kingdom, and like her English grandmother, one of the most famous royal carriers of hemophilia. She converted to Russian Orthodox, became the empress after joining with Emperor Nicholas, and bore him a hemophiliac heir, their son, Prince Alexei Nikolaevich. When Rasputin's reputation as a healer reached Alexandra, she saw in him a hope in finding a cure for her son's affliction. Even though some members of court saw Rasputin as nothing more than a religious charlatan, his tending to the prince's ailment seemed to work. Alexei's bleeding subsided, and suddenly, Rasputin found himself very well received in the house of Romanov. After healing the prince, Rasputin became a controversial fixture at the royal court, forever shadowing the empress as her personal advisor. Some even believed he greatly influenced decisions being made at the highest levels. Officials were not happy. As Russia entered World War I, Rasputin made a prediction. A calamity would surely befall the country. He was not wrong. And after Nicholas took command of the Russian army in 1915, Alexandra took command of Russian domestic policy. Rasputin's influence naturally grew. Politicians tried to warn her that her closeness to the monk was strange and it did not look good for her politically, but forever Rasputin's advocate, she defended him again, asserting he was her most trusted advisor. Local journalists and politicians seized on the opportunity. They scandalized Rasputin's association with the imperial family in an attempt to undermine the dynasty's credibility. It seemed to work. And when rumors of Rasputin's lascivious nature emerged, it seemed to be the controversial straw that broke the political camel's back. His sexual exploits were legendary. His member was rumored to be so large and his sexual abilities so powerful that women were reported to faint from the experience of pleasure. Controversy and the political pressure it caused was reaching a climax. The perverted prophet had gone too far, and he'd overstayed his welcome. On the night of December 29th, 1916, a group of conspirators, including the Tsar's first cousin, Grand Duke Dmitry Pavlovich, and Prince Felix Yusupov, invited Rasputin to Yusupov's palace and fed him wine and cakes laced with cyanide. The conspirators waited for Rasputin to meet his quiet end, but they did not get what they were expecting. The poison food and drink seemed to have no effect. Baffled but not deterred, a fight ensued, culminating in Rasputin being shot 3 times, including in the back and once in the head. Supernaturally, Rasputin rose again, just before the men pounced on him and beat him to near death. Legend says his penis was then cut off by Prince Felix Yusupov, unceremoniously discarded and secretly gathered up and saved by one of Yusupov's servants, who was a follower of the mystic Eastern Orthodoxy. Still alive, his body was then wrapped in a carpet and thrown into the Neva River, where it was discovered 3 days later. It was death by drowning, the icy waters finally claiming Rasputin's life. Lore tells us that in the 1920s, Rasputin's penis had made its way all the way to France as a talisman and sexual artifact, believed to possess supernatural powers. Furthermore,
Rasputin's daughter Maria discovered a group of women in Paris that had been venerating her father's penis, believing it could bestow fertility just by looking at it. The artifact now resides in the Museum of Erotica in St. Petersburg, Russia. Although Rasputin was gone, the last of his prophecies was yet to unfold. Just before his death, he wrote to the emperor to predict that if he were to be killed by the Russian government, it would seal the fate of the entire imperial family, that they too would all die. Within a year and a half, his prophecy came true when the Tsar, his wife, and all of their children were murdered by assassins amidst the Russian Revolution, thus ending the great Russian Romanov dynasty. That's all the time we have for now, children. If you're enjoying the Boulay Brothers Creatures of the Night, we want to remind you to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and to also encourage everyone you know to do the same. We'll see you back here on the next episode of Dread Central's Boulay Brothers Creatures of the Night. Thanks for listening. The Boulay Brothers Creatures of the Night is a Dread Central production, hosted by the Boulay Brothers with their co-host and producer, Ian DeVogler. Engineered and mixed by Carlos Bueno, with music by Neuron Spectre.